Advancing Public Well-Being Through Improved Communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the talented Hugo Wolf Quartet on February 19th. More information is available online at krannertcenter.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria Restaurant in downtown Champaign. Radio Maria serves dinner and tapas every evening, lunch on Fridays and Saturdays from 11:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m., and a Sunday brunch. Registration is available for emails on news, menu changes, and upcoming special events.
Wow, what an intro to Sky Guys. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and 90.9 HD2, also online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm meteorologist Ed Kieser, one half of the Sky Guys team, and I think to be appropriate with the music, I've just got to say, hello, Dave.
You know how many times I hear that? I'm tired of that. I should change my name.
Well, you didn't pick your name. That's
true.
That came when...
A couple of good people do that.
Yeah, you had a couple of good people do that. Your parents in Decatur. Maybe they're tuning in today. Anyway, we're going to be taking questions today of anything related to the sky. So if you have a meteorological or weather question, not a forecast question, but general weather question, we'll be glad to take it. Or if you have an astronomy question, once we get the weather stuff out of the way so you can see farther into the heavens, we'll be glad to take your questions here on Sky Guys on the Afternoon Magazine. The number to call, well, there's actually two numbers. You can call locally at 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. Numbers once again, 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. And well, Dave, it's been a while since we've done this show. First one of the new year. And since I'm talking, I guess I can ask the first question or to kind of follow up on an observation. Venus in the evening sky has just been brilliant for a long time now. Is this unusual to have that display of Venus this long? It seems for months now that we've been able to see it, and it's really, I think, more noticeable in the past. Maybe I just didn't notice in the past. But
it's been there. It spent most of the end of last year in the morning sky and then shifted into the evening sky. And it will be there for about another month or so. Towards maybe the third week of March, you're going to see it's going to definitely be setting earlier and getting closer to the sun because it's about ready to swing between the sun and the earth. But, yeah, it is pretty brilliant.
Yeah, I stand corrected there. That's right. Last year, for much of the latter part of last year, I was in the morning sky. I was working mornings.
There you go. Yeah, I bet you saw
it. I switched to evenings here, so that's why I've got the perception of just seeing Venus all the time.
Maybe your schedule kind of matches the cycle of Venus.
My schedule matches Venus, exactly. Well, that's it. But that is that bright object that you see in the southwest sky after sunset.
Looks like an airplane, and its landing lights on, coming in for a landing.
And what other planets can you see right now?
Right now, right about the time Venus sets, Saturn comes up due east. It's not near as brilliant as Venus is, but there's not a lot of other really bright stars in the area, so you ought to be able to see it pretty easy with just your eyes. Of course, a telescope will show the rings, but you can actually see Saturn with just the old eyeballs.
And Jupiter not around right now?
Early morning, right before the sun comes up, Jupiter and Mars are there, kind of pretty low in the sky.
So Mike Sola might see those planets coming into work early in the morning.
As long as, yeah, but if he's driving, I hope not.
Okay. Well, he has to drive on his way here. But anyway, we are talking about astronomy. We are talking about weather, and we invite you to join in on the conversation. The number to call, once again, 217-333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. If you got some questions, we'd love to take them. And, of course, hopefully, if you have a question, you call in before the last 5 minutes of the show. It seems whenever we do these shows, the last 5 minutes, the phones really fill up. So get in early, and you can get your questions answered for sure.
I was going to ask you what the temperature was outside right now, because it's beautiful outside.
42 degrees. It's sunny, and I have to say I went down to where I think half of Champaign County is right now. I went to check out the going out of business sale at Pages for All Ages Bookstore in Savoy, which we're sad to see go. They've been a great sponsor of WILL over the years, very supportive. But I can tell you, I don't think I've ever seen a store so full of people. Just amazing. I couldn't get anything because I had to come here to do the show, and it was
jam-packed,
take
huh?
too long to check out. Anyway, we have a caller on line one from Champaign. Good afternoon. Welcome to Sky Guys. Well, I guess line one is not there. So in that
it was probably my broker.
Oh, great. Okay, so we'll go to line four in Belgium. Okay, apparently we have technical difficulties, and the calls have temporarily left the phone system.
Please call back.
Well, we'll see what happened. I'll be told when we have calls again, but sometimes this happens, and right now the phone system is having a little bit of problems. So anyway, the weather is beautiful right now, but okay, I'm told now to let's try line four. I believe this caller is calling from Belgium. Good afternoon. Welcome to Sky Guys.
Yes, good afternoon to you, gentlemen. I'd like to bring up a topic that maybe we can just speculate on a little bit. Couple, 3 or 4 days ago, a while back, a couple of satellites crashed into each other up in the lower altitudes of our atmosphere. And they seem to be going to cause us an amazing amount of trouble in the future if these parts go scattering into other things that are floating around up there also. I wondered if your people could discuss that just a bit.
Well, that will be a Dave answer.
Well, yeah, and there's not really a lot of information yet. I can tell you it was an American satellite, an Iridium satellite, and also one called Cosmos 2251 that were actually collided with each other. And when I first heard that, I was kind of skeptical at first until I got more information because, yes, there's a lot of stuff up there in space, but there's also a lot of space. And the fact that two things would actually hit has been fairly rare. I mean, when you think of all the, even from the old moonshots, you know, all these parts of rockets and things that are up there in space. So, yeah, it was kind of interesting. But from what I understand, they were not quite 500 miles up, about 490. And I wish they could have got it on film because they said they closed at about 15,000 miles an hour because they were coming kind of from different directions. So
So were these polar orbiting satellites?
I believe one was.
Okay, and that's how there was the collision.
Yeah, and they happened over Siberia. And from what I understand, they're tracking about 280 pieces of debris right now. And it's not going to impact the space station, so we don't have to worry about that. But just there's other communication satellites that I suppose there could be some problems.
And most satellites are either what we call polar orbiting or geosynchronous, which means they keep their same position generally over the equator, about 22,000 miles up, meaning they're in sync. They're synced up with the Earth's orbit. So it looks like the satellite stays in the same place, even though it's moving at a faster speed than the Earth to keep up.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. In fact, that's a good physics problem that we do in classes to figure out how high that it have to be to do that. So, but yeah, it'll be interesting to see the maybe fallout's a bad word, but to see what kind of comes of this. And there's nothing in any imminent danger at the moment, but again, they're tracking these 280 pieces, and who knows the pieces that we're not tracking that might be too small to pick up. So, but yeah, that's something that just happened not long ago. It's kind of an interesting development.
And I'm sure this is something that we'll hear more about in the future as more and more satellites go up there and space becomes more crowded.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff up there right now.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your call. And we move on now to Line 1 in Urbana. Good afternoon. Welcome to Sky Guys.
Is that me?
That is you. You're on the air.
What kind of conditions produce the phenomenon that people call sun dogs?
Sun dogs, okay. Basically, you need cirrostratus clouds or clouds of that ilk, which are rather high in the sky, at least 5 miles up in the sky, and are made of ice crystals. And the ice crystals are such that they collectively act as a prism. So sunlight is refracted through the ice crystals in a way that you see splotches of light to the right and or left of the sun, about 22 degrees or so right and left of the sun. You can only see them when the sun is low in the sky, because that's the only way that it works out to where the sun's rays are able to go through those ice crystals in such a way that you get that effect to your eye. And sometimes they just like look like blotches of kind of an orangish light. But when you have a really strong sun dog, you actually see different colors because it's light being refracted. So the different color wavelengths of light break up into the different colors, the shortest wavelength being violet, the longest being red of the visible spectrum. And so sometimes you can see that rainbow effect. It's not a rainbow, but it's a refraction of light through the ice crystals of the clouds.
Ice crystals.
Yes. So they have to be ice crystal clouds for that to happen.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling. You're listening to Sky Guys on the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. I'm meteorologist Ed Kieser, along with Dave Lee, coordinator of the William M. Starkel Planetarium at Parkland College. And we're taking your calls regarding anything sky. It could be weather, it could be astronomy. And the number to call if you have a question or a comment is 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Of course, that 800 number is a toll-free number, 800-222-9455. And you can call anywhere in the United States toll-free. And I know that WILL now has some listeners here and there all over the country, as we're online at will.illinois.edu. And more and more people are listening to us online. So we could end up conceivably getting a call from far away.
From over Siberia.
Well, that could happen. We've had some listeners in other parts of the world even contact
Very
us.
Very good.
So anyway, we're looking at, let's see here. I don't know if that's line one. Is that a new call? I think we might have a new call coming in a moment. I guess we could talk a little bit about other things happening in astronomy.
I got a picture. Pictures don't lend itself to radio very well, do they? But I have a picture of
the Pinwheel Galaxy.
Messier 101, which is the Pinwheel Galaxy. And we're going to be unveiling a photograph of this, and actually several photographs. One is from the Hubble, one's from the Spitzer Space Telescope, and the other from the Chandra X-ray Observatory. We're going to do this Tuesday around 5 o'clock. It's free, so if anybody wants to come out, we're going to have a few folks say a few words. Our president, Tom Ramage, will be saying a few words, and we're going to try to get somebody who actually helped take this photograph actually come out and speak to us, and we're actually going to unveil this thing. It's going to be mounted in our lobby, but we're very happy. We were one of about 100 institutions across this nation that were awarded these prints. So
Okay, pretty so neat Tuesday at the Planetarium
at Tuesday,
Parkland.
Right around 5 o'clock if anybody wants to stop in.
Okay.
But you can have that. We were sent a number of different prints. We'll have some other prints. I was sent a package of them. So if you want a print of the Messier 101, the Pinwheel Galaxy, we'll have those there too. And maybe even a few refreshments.
Okay. Well, we're now going to take another call.
Sounds good.
We've got one. And this one is coming from Champagne on line two. Or it's...
Yes. You hear me?
Yes.
I got cut off earlier, so I wanted to be careful.
We apologize. We had a few problems with the phone system, but it appears to be working now.
Well, we really appreciate WILL, so don't worry about it. Here's the question. I was listening to a radio station up in Chicago, a big-name radio station, and the radio on-air personality was shouting about the cold winter we're having, and how doesn't that prove that there's no global warming? What do you think of that? Call us up. And I thought, I wonder what Ed Kieser would say. Is this statistically proving that there's no global warming? And how would you respond to that kind of thought? I'll hang up and listen.
Well, simply I would say any weather event or any period of weather, say a cold winter or a hot summer or a year with lots of hurricanes or a year with little hurricanes or a year with lots of tornadoes or a year with little tornadoes, there's variability. And you can't take one event and say, that's global warming, or, that means there is no global warming. So that's the first thing I'd say. You can't look at short-term fluctuations in the weather and attribute it to global climate change directly. Now, if those events occur more frequently over a longer period of time and you start to see a trend, then you can maybe make some comment there. But it's irresponsible for anybody to say, it's a cold winter, there's no global warming, just as it's irresponsible if we have a heat wave in summer. Well, see, there's global warming, it's here. Because we've had both ways, we've had these types of weather events have occurred over the decades and centuries, and there's going to continue to be variability in the weather with climate change, and the climate's always changing. So I'll just say those comments are not responsible, and I avoid them.
What kind of a swing did we have there? Because we were in single digits there for a while, and then all of a sudden we almost did. In fact, did we reach 70?
We did not reach 70 here, but we did get into the mid-60s.
That was an amazing swing.
It was an amazing swing, and we have had a lot of amazing swings over the years. And I think in the last decade or so, we've seen more amazing swings maybe than we used to. I think with all the mild winters that we had in the 90s, and we had many winters that were mild, and early in this decade, we did have some record cold. In fact, in 1994 and 1999, we tied our all-time record low temperature, 25 below zero, here in Champaign-Urbana. So there is variability. And the other thing, too, with climate change, and I like to use the term climate change rather than global warming, the Earth's atmosphere overall is warming when you average out the entire Earth. But there's still that doesn't mean every place on Earth is going to get warmer. Some places will get warmer faster. Some other places will get cooler with climate change. And so the term global warming sometimes implies things that aren't. Scientists know what global warming means, but the general public, I think, just perceives that every place is warming up, and that's not the case either. It's a very complex problem. Anyway, let's see. Somebody asked, do I have an answer for severe clear? How often do they occur? I don't know if I know exactly what severe clear means. Okay. Well, it was a caller that's not on board anymore. I don't know if I don't have a definition for severe clear.
Yeah, it's
I don't know if it just means the sky is extremely clear. I can tell you the best clear sky you can find is during Arctic air masses in winter, and we've had some beautiful clear nights here this winter with some of those single digit and below zero cold. That's because you don't have as much water vapor in the air, so you don't have as much haze. Your clearest conditions occur in the middle of winter. So you know, being a stargazer and astronomer, that usually to find the best sky viewing, you have to bundle up.
Yeah, you got to really put on the layers. And I've also found that the older I get, the less impervious I am to the cold. I used to go out and shovel my backyard just to put a telescope out there, but don't do that too much anymore.
Well, anyway, I'm not sure if that's what the listener meant. I invite the listener to call back if they want more clarification on that. But anyway, I think we have one caller now on line one in Urbana. Why don't we take that? Good afternoon. Welcome to Sky Guys.
Hi there. Interesting show. I have a sort of a question and a proposal. I've been following the ozone hole for a while now. And I understand that obviously making a bunch of ozone at ground level is going to be very bad for people, and that it takes a very long time for ozone to get to the 20,000-30,000 feet that it needs to be to affect the ozone hole. I also understand that as of about this year, that air traffic is now beginning to be an actual problem with pollution. So I'm wondering if, in fact, since most of the commercial flights fly at 20 to 30,000 feet, is there some reason that you might know of that they can't, I mean, ozone is very easy to produce, that they can't produce at least as much ozone as they take out of the atmosphere with their pollution? That's my question. And I'll listen off air.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not an expert at all on what kind of ozone can be produced by aircraft. Just talking about ozone for a moment. The ozone hole is a thinning of the amount of ozone in the stratosphere, which occurs naturally in the stratosphere. Stratospheric ozone is up around 20, 30,000 feet up in the atmosphere. So, or actually, it's 20 to 30 miles up in the atmosphere. So it's not a 20 or 30,000 feet. So airplanes fly way lower than where the stratospheric ozone that protects us exists. And what ozone does in the stratosphere is it absorbs the majority of the ultraviolet radiation that comes in from the sun. And, of course, the ultraviolet radiation is the damaging shortwave radiation that causes skin cancer and cataracts and premature aging of skin. And
suntans.
Well.
what does come through.
Yeah, and if you're 20 and you're out trying to get a suntan, then you regret it at 50 when you look like you're 70 because it does prematurely age the skin. And I've not been a big sun worshiper over my life, but I had a dermatologist once years ago tell me to get some sun for a skin condition I had, and now I'm paying the price for that because 30 years ago, what was being told what was a good idea then is now, in hindsight, not such a good idea. But that's a digression there. Anyway, ozone in the stratosphere occurs naturally, and it absorbs much of, not all of, but much of the ultraviolet radiation that comes in from the sun. The ozone, the concentration of ozone in the stratosphere started to decrease, and it was found it was due to, in large part, chlorofluorocarbons being released into the lower atmosphere, and somehow those CFCs got up to the ozone and started munching on it. I always kind of envision the chlorofluorocarbons being like Pac-Man munching on ozone. And that was a commonly found in spray cans and air conditioning refrigerant, and a lot of changes have been made due to global treaties. Sometimes all the countries around the world do work together, and chlorofluorocarbons were eliminated from refrigerant and spray cans about a couple decades ago. So that situation's improving slowly. Now, ozone is also produced during combustion and hangs out in the lower atmosphere on stagnant, warm days when we have a temperature inversion, and it's a pollutant at ground level. Now, I don't know how you can really just take ozone at the ground and get it up to the stratosphere. I think really what's happening is stratospheric ozone has to replenish itself over time, and that's why there's still a depletion of ozone, even though the chlorofluorocarbons aren't being sent up there to eat it anymore. But I don't think we can take ozone at the ground and just send it up to 20 miles, 30 kilometers up into the atmosphere. And Dave, I don't know if you have anything to add to that at all or not.
That's just as far as the ultraviolet goes, but yeah, as far as the somehow getting it back there, yeah, that's a little beyond my expertise.
And airplanes do, of course, produce exhaust and pollution, and that is of concern. But really, 30,000 feet is only roughly 6 miles up, so not even halfway up to where the ozone naturally exists in the stratosphere. But anyway, we thank our that caller for his question. And if you have a question about anything related to the sky, give us a call. We're here to answer your question. This is a periodic program we do on the afternoon magazine called Sky Guys. I'm meteorologist Ed Kieser, along with Dave Leak, coordinator of the William M. Starkel Planetarium at Parkland College. Dave is an expert on things related to astronomy, and I'm handling the weather questions here. So anything related to the sky, we'll be glad to take your call. 333-9455. That's 333-WILL or toll free 1-800-222-9455. And we'll be glad to take your questions. And I know that this is a day where a lot of people are outside driving around. And
it's a beautiful day.
Yeah, so maybe we don't have quite as many calls as we do on a cloudy day, but it's a good day to get in if you are listening and you are near a phone. And now I see by giving the phone number out, a few calls are starting to come in, so we'll be taking some shortly. And I have a caller now on line one. Good afternoon. Welcome to Sky Guys on the Afternoon Magazine.
Hi, guys. I've been looking up on the western sky in the evening, and there's a bright object. I was wondering whether that's a planet or that's a star. What is it?
That would be Venus, right?
Yeah, that's something that Ed mentioned at the beginning of the show. Yeah, that's the brilliant planet Venus, which is bright because it's close by. In fact, none of the other planets come closer to us than Venus does, and it also has some very highly reflective clouds, which also make it very bright. And Venus is again starting to pass between the Sun and the Earth, so it's kind of interesting that if you look at Venus through a telescope, it's becoming more and more of a crescent. And so Venus's size, it's getting thinner, but it also appears to be getting longer, if that makes sense. You know, like the crescent is stretching a little bit. So, but yeah, it's really bright this month.
Yeah, and I think, too, we were talking about some of your best clear conditions are in the winter. So that's probably aiding in its brilliance, just that we don't have all the haze in the sky as we do in the summertime, too.
And here's something for you to try. I've never seen this myself, but if you can get out where it's really dark, and that's kind of tough to do because Venus still has to be above the horizon. So after sunset, but I've been told that you can actually like hold your hand up in front of a white sheet of paper and you can cast a shadow just from the light of Venus.
Oh, okay.
But you try that sometime, but you do have to get, you know, if you got any street lights around, that's not gonna work.
It's kind of hard to see because we live right in town. Maybe unless we drive a little bit out of town.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your call. And I think Venus has been the most brilliant, interesting thing to see in the sky lately. So it's good to get that answered. And we now move along to line two, Urbana, a caller from Urbana. Good afternoon. Welcome to Sky Guys.
Good afternoon. Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay, I'm sorry. They didn't tell me which line.
Oh, okay. You're on two.
Okay. I had heard that there's going to be a comet visible in the sky later this month. Is that true, or can you expand on that at all?
Dave can do that?
Yeah, and the thing that's going to be embarrassing is I'm not 100% sure how to pronounce the darn thing. It's
it's one of those. It's not like high karate. No, what was it? What was it? Hiyataki?
Hiyakitaki. Yeah. No, it's spelled L-U-L-I-N. So is that Lulin? That's what I'm going to call it. We'll just sort of say that right here until someone corrects me. But yeah, it was discovered actually last summer by a young Chinese student using just kind of a backyard telescope. And, of course, the closer the comets get to the sun, the brighter they get. And let's see, today is the 13th. So the comet is going to be getting close to the star Spica, which will be a bright star that will be coming up in the southeastern part of the sky.
Oh, wow. You've got your sky chart here.
Oh, yeah. We come prepared for these things here.
All right.
So let's see. Spica is going to be coming up probably around 10:30 at night. So it'll be a star in the southeast. And so you want to look a little bit after that. And I'd use binoculars. There's a chance this thing could reach a naked eye brightness. But the weird thing about comets is that they're so unpredictable. You think the economy is bad. Comets, we don't know really from day to day what's really going to happen to them. But the thing that will be interesting is as we get closer to the end of February, it'll pass, when I say close to the Earth, that's 38 million miles. So it's not real close. But you'll actually be able to see it moving in a telescope. You know, anything close, you'll be able to see it. Be able to see it moving. So, like, just watching it in a telescope, it'll kind of slowly drift across the field of view, and not just from the Earth turning either. So, should be interesting.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your call.
And yeah, thanks a lot.
You talk about comets being unpredictable. I do remember as a kid reading about Halley's Comet, and I couldn't wait for 1986, and frankly, that was a huge disappointment. But then Hale-Bopp, on the other hand, and then I think that other one,
Hyakutake.
Those were better than Halley's this time around, I think.
Yeah, and the thing about Halley's, in fact— I might be working at the planetarium now just because of that, because I did a lot of stuff in the community because Halley's, remember, Halley's was actually on TV. In fact, I think Halley's Comet was a guest on Ted Koppel's Nightline at one time. I don't think it was a very good interview, but there was a big buildup, but the astronomers knew that Halley's Comet was going to be closest to the sun when the Earth was on the other side of the sun. So we just had to catch it before it went around and then after it came out. And so, yeah, we didn't actually see it at its brightest.
But there have been times in past history when it's been obviously impressive, or else there wouldn't have been all the hype going into
it. Yeah, 1910 was wonderful. I mean, so I hear.
Yeah. And will we be around for the next one?
Well, I don't know. Maybe they'll... the wheel us out of the Inman, right?
Yeah, or something like that. We might as well move along here. We have several callers on board now, so we'll go to line three. Our next caller is from Coles County. Good afternoon.
Yes, I'm not sure this question is appropriate, but I have read in several articles in astronomy that space is expanding, and it's never been clear to me just how this expansion is taking place. It could be in terms of sort of the frontiers of space are moving farther out, or it could be that if we think of space as quantized, that the number of quanta, if space quanta, are increasing, or the size of a quanta is increasing. Yeah, can you help me on this?
Well, let's see. There's actually probably a couple of 2 or 3 hour-long lectures involved in that one, but I'll try to give you the brief answer. What they found back, I believe, was in the 50s, middle of the last century, was when we looked at all these galaxies in space, they were all moving away from us, with maybe a couple of exceptions. So that was kind of odd. Why would everything be moving away from us? And the conclusion was that there wasn't really anything special about us. It's just that, the example that's used a lot. And there are some problems with this demonstration, but if you think about it, is you blow up a balloon halfway, put some dots on the balloon and have those be your galaxies, and then blow the balloon up more. And it doesn't matter which dot you live on, the other ones are going to look like they're moving away. So in that case, space is really the balloon, and it's almost as if it's stretching and getting bigger that way. Now, the problem with that is that if you're in a room and you do that, you think, oh, the balloon is expanding into the room. Well, there isn't anything outside of the balloon as far as the universe goes. Like, that's it. And also, a balloon is – the surface of a balloon is a two-dimensional analog. So if you have to then add a dimension to that. And it gets pretty crazy. We try to talk about that in Parkland College astronomy classes, and it's not the easiest concept to get across.
Yeah, well, I don't expect an answer on this now because we just don't have time. But I've always wondered, with space expanding, what's on the other side of the edge of space?
Well, that it's sort of like asking what day is between Monday and Tuesday. I mean, it just it's kind of a meaningless question because everything there is what's doing the expanding. So don't think of it expanding into something. Is and you know that's a difficult concept to
exactly.
try to get across. So
and we don't have time for it. But when you start thinking about those things, that makes me just want to take another caller and move on. So we're going to go to line four.
It's a good question, though.
Yeah, well, with not an easy answer. Line four in Charleston. Welcome to Sky Guys on the Afternoon Magazine.
I have kind of an unusual question. I have a window that's partially facing west. Inside that window, I have pictures on the wall. To protect the pictures from sunlight, I have to lower the window or the shade as the sun is getting lower in the afternoon. Now, during the summertime, I have to do this, but I don't have to do it this time of year. How can that be? West is west, always west.
Well, and we could probably both answer that one for you, but
we can. I'll let you try because whenever I teach this at Parkland, my students still don't understand it collectively.
Well,
it seems to be the hardest concept.
Yeah, and it's a visual thing, so you have to forgive me because it's going to be tough to do this on radio, but it has to do with the tilt of the Earth's axis, and as we go around the sun. What we find is that the sunset isn't always in the same spot, or sunrise for that matter. In fact, in the wintertime, the sun sets pretty much in the southwest, and in the summertime, it sets in the northwest. Only during the first day of spring and first day of fall does it actually set due west. So it's a seasonal effect, and it's interesting how a lot of people go through life and never really notice this. But ancient folks all across the globe actually sometimes use this as a calendar because the sunset doesn't always set or rise in the same spot. You know, what the caller's getting at, we're all taught, you know, sun rises mm-hmm. in the east and set in the west, and that's not always the case.
No, in fact, most of the time it's not. One thing I can add to that is around here in the flatlands of Illinois, most roads are on a grid north, south, east, west. Mm-hmm. And on an east-west road, right around the vernal equinox in March, around March 20th, and the autumnal equinox around September 22nd in the fall, the sun sets due west. And driving westbound at that time of year is a problem right around sunset. Mm-hmm. But most of the winter and most of the summer, it's not a problem. So that's the one way you can tell that it's due west or due east for the sunrise is by going out on one of those east-west roads right around equinox time. So here as we go into March and we're getting closer to March 20th, the sun will be setting closer to due west, and that's going to make traveling westbound at sunset a little bit problematic.
And it's a great, great teaching thing. Actually, mark it. Mark like the shadow of something, and went right when the sun is setting, and you know put just a little mark somewhere and watch how it does change. It's really interesting.
And the other thing too with that is with the tilt of the axis of the Earth, as far as opening and closing shades too, the midday sun right at the halfway point between sunrise and sunset is lowest on the first day of winter around December 21st, and it's highest in June around June 21st. And in Champaign-Urbana, the maximum angle above the horizon on December 21st at midday is just 26.5 degrees. But on June 21st, it's 73.5 degrees above the horizon. Sun is much higher, and that's why it's warmer in the summer. We get more direct radiation to heat the Earth in the summer. I hope that helps.
Good question.
And that caller's gone, so we're going to move along to line one in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Well, I have two questions, one for each one of you. My mother used to say, with those mare's tails, we're going to get rain. So that's Ed's question. And Dave's question is, if the particles of that collision up outer space do hit the Hubble space mirrors, telescope, what damage would it do?
You want to do yours first?
Yeah, I'll take care of the mare's tails. That would be wispy cirrus clouds high in the sky, and they're made of ice crystals. And what happens oftentimes with a warm front approaching is you have the cold air near the ground, and warm air is forced to rise aloft, and that rising air cools, condenses, and makes clouds. And when you're far away from the surface warm front, those clouds are higher up. So the mare's tails are the first signs of cloudiness with an approaching warm front, and as that front gets closer, the wedge of cold air near the ground gets thinner, and the clouds get lower and thicker. So there's a lot of truth to the mare's tails meaning rain within 24 to 48 hours. So some of the old sayings actually do have a lot of practical application, and that's one of them. So usually when you see the mare's tails clouds, which are the cirrus clouds, then within the next day, you'll probably start to see altocumulus and altostratus clouds, and then the clouds get lower to the nimbostratus, which produces rain, snow, or a mix, depending on the temperature in the year. And space debris, Dave, I'm guessing that the odds of any of that debris hitting one particular thing is still small because there's a lot of space out there, but I'll let you answer that.
It would be pretty small. I was going through a few notes here, and I actually thought I had this, and still think I do, but I haven't found it yet. As far as how high the Hubble's orbit is, it's pretty far up there. I know, just because of such things, they wanted to kind of get it out away from the Earth. If it's too close to the Earth, it's it kind of narrows your field of view. So I was looking for the height of the Hubble above the surface of the Earth and can't seem to find it. I do know, as Ed says, that the fact that this collision happened is kind of an odd thing. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. And the Hubble does actually have a cover that it can put over the end of the telescope. So if there was something that they were tracking that was by chance getting close, they could actually cover the telescope so nothing got inside. But I'm pretty sure the Hubble is higher, though. I'd have to double check that.
Does that answer your questions? I guess our caller is not there now. Well, anyway, we have only about 5 minutes left. If you have a quick question on the atmosphere, is she here? No, okay. If you have anything about the atmosphere or up higher above the atmosphere in outer space, give us a call, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Question I have about the space debris, would most of it, at least for a while, stay pretty close to the same altitude above the Earth, kind of stay in orbit at the altitude of where these two satellites collided?
Well, again, probably just... It depends on how the things collided. Think about billiard balls smacking into each other. If something was knocked downward, then I suppose that would decay fairly quickly. So, there's a certain speed you have to travel to stay in these orbits. And so if something's knocked out of that, it's possible. I don't think anything's going to reach escape velocity. But I would imagine some of the stuff will probably end up burning up and some will stay in orbit.
And is there a chance any of it could hit the ground, or would the debris be small enough that it would all just burn up before ever hitting the ground?
Well, because satellites aren't that huge to begin with. And again, since this just happened, of these 280 bits that they're tracking, I really don't have any idea what size these things are. So, there's a chance for most of that stuff, though, like the meteorites, you have to be, basketball size or maybe something a little bigger to actually hit the ground. But for this stuff, I don't know.
Okay, well, now we're getting a flurry of callers. So we'll
right
have
at
to,
the end.
Yeah, so we'll have to take a few of these rather quickly. We're now going to go to line one in Muhammad. Good afternoon.
Hi. I've got a couple things. Dave, if you would take time to maybe talk about the programs that are going to be shown at the planetarium starting this weekend, that'd be a good thing. And then a comment about the weather forecasting, which I really appreciate. One of the things that I always am curious about, and I never really hear, and you might do this, I'm not sure, Ed, but when a forecast is way out of bounds, I'm always curious as to what happened, because I think that's really neat or interesting to hear why the forecast was wrong, because you guys are pretty accurate. So that's it.
Yeah, well, I'll just quickly say when the forecast is really way off, which fortunately it's not way off too often, I will make comments on what happened. I'm not afraid to do that. I know some people have to be perceived as being right all the time, and you know, I'll take my lumps when they come. So I think that's educational for everybody.
And I'll just say quickly, because I know we don't have time left, but as far as the planetarium programming, you can call our show hotline at 351-2446, and it's also on the website. But our new show called The Planets is Friday and Saturday at 8 o'clock, and we've actually had some pretty good crowds come out to that. It's kind of an odd thing for us because it's a tour of the solar system, but it's made for a more adult audience. It's not not for the little kids like most of our other solar system tours. So that's the probably our main news show that we're doing right now.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. We'll move on to line 4 in Bloomington. Good afternoon. Welcome to Sky Guys.
Is there such a thing at the University of Illinois as the Arctic Climate Research Center?
I don't think there's an Arctic Climate Research Center, but the Atmospheric Sciences Department does have some faculty and staff that specialize in polar research.
And well, I'm looking at a newsletter that says the Arctic Climate Research Center at the University of Illinois.
Well, maybe there is one, and I'm just not aware of the official name. I will say there are faculty and staff in the Atmospheric Sciences Department that do specialize in polar and Arctic climate, including Professor John Walsh. He's a retired professor that spends half his time here and half his time in Alaska, and others in the department. So they do research on that.
But this says that the center released satellite photos showing that the amount of Arctic ice is back to 1979 levels, and the Antarctic ice has increased 5% since 1980. That's from a group at U of I?
I can't comment on that because I have not seen that. If you have a publication on that, I would follow up with where that came from if you have questions. I'm sorry, I don't know any more about the specifics of that.
Is there a website on the newsletter?
Pardon?
Is there a website on the newsletter? Or if there is, I just check that out and see if it's got an illinois.edu on the end of it.
Oh, no. It's a compilation of all kinds of things, but it just cited the Arctic Climate Research Center at the University of Illinois, and I said, gee, I didn't know that was there.
Well, I don't know of that as an official name. I do know of some professors and staff, academic professional type people that do specialize in Arctic research, though, climate research, that there are people that do that at the University of Illinois. Thank you very much for your call. We have come to the end of our time. Dave, again, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me. That went fast.
Yeah, it went fast indeed. And we will do this again sometime. Never know when. But this is the latest edition of Sky Guys on the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. And our thanks this afternoon to Technical Director Henry Frain and Producer Harriet Williamson. It's now coming up on 1:54, time for the closing prices and on the commodities. And with that, we go to Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much there, Ed. Let's take a look at those numbers as they settled in Chicago. On this Friday afternoon, futures like this in the wheat pit, the nearby March contract, 545.5, the high, the low at 34.5, and a settlement price at 535.5, down 3.25 for the day. May futures at 557.75, top, bottom at 47. Settlement price at 548.25, down 3.25, and July futures down 3 cents, 570, the high, the low at 560. Settlement price at 560.75, down 3. And September futures, 594.75, the high, the low at 584.75. Settlement price at $5.85, down 3.75 for the September wheat. In Kansas City, nearby March contract for the hard red, 574.5, a settlement price a half lower. The May down a penny at 583.75. Quiet day in Chicago for the corn pit as well, at least on the close. 371, the high, the low at 363. A fairly narrow trading range for corn in these periods. 3 cents lower today, 363.25. The settlement price for the March contract down 3 at 363.25. May corn futures, 80.5, the high, the low at 72.5. Settlement price, $3.73 and a quarter, down 2 3/4 in July. 390 and a quarter, the high, the low at 82 3/4. Settlement price at 383 and a quarter, down 2 1/4. September futures, 399 3/4, the high, low at 393. Settlement price at 393 and a quarter, down 2 3/4. In December corn futures, 412 and a half, the high, low at $4.05. Settlement price at 405 and a half, down 2 1/4 in the December corn. That's the new crop, of course, and the March of 2010 settled at 418 and a half, down 2 1/2 cents for the day. March oat futures, $1.93 and a quarter, the high, the low at $1.82 3/4. Settlement price at $1.84 and a half, down 6 cents. And the May oats, $1.99 and a quarter, the high, the low at $1.91 3/4. Settlement price at $1.93 and a half, down 5. March soybean futures, $9.81 and a half, the high, the low at 55. Settlement price a half above that at $9.55 and a half a bushel. The March oats, or rather soybeans, down 13 cents in the May contract. 983 and a half, the high, low at 956 and a half. Settlement price 957 3/4, down 13 3/4. July futures 987 and a half, the high, the low at 61 1/4. Settlement price $9.62, down 14 cents for July beans. In the August, 974, the high, the low at 49 1/2. Settlement price at $9.50, down 14. September futures 935 and a half, the high, the low at 911 and a half. Settlement price 13.5 cents lower at $9.13.5. And the November contract, 912, the high, the low at 891 1/4. Settlement price at $8.92.5, 8 cents lower for the day. The March bean meal at 308.10 on the high, the low at 297.50. Settlement price there at $297.70, down $7. The May bean meal, $295, down $6.60 on the day. Soybean oil futures, 33.29, the high, the low at 32.54. Settled at $33 even, 17 lower. In the May contract, 33.59, the high, the low at 32.87. Settlement price, 33.34, 19 higher. Over at the CME's livestock side, February live cattle today had a high price of $84.65, a low at $84. Settlement price, $84 and a nickel, down 30 cents. April futures, $87.95 on the high, the low at $86.90. Settlement price, $87 even, down 50 cents. In June, live cattle, 85, 52 and a half the high, low at 84.75. Settlement price at $84.80 for 100 pounds, down 42 and a half cents. August contract, 75 cents lower, with a top of 86.30, a bottom at 85.30. And the live cattle for the August future settled 85.40, down 75. March feeder cattle, 95.65 the high, the low at 94.10. Settlement price at 94.47 and a half, 67 and a half cents lower. April futures, 96.70 to the high, the low at 95.25. Settlement price at 95.47 and a half, 67 and a half lower. And the May feeder cattle, 98.25 the high, the low at 96.80. Settlement price 97.15, down 65 cents. August, $100.25 the high, the low at $99.05. Settlement price 99.45, down 55 for the August feeder cattle. Now the lean hog futures February contract, April contract, $64 the high, the low at 63.35. Settlement price 63.75, a nickel lower. The May futures 74.95, the high, the low at 74.50. Settlement price at 74.90, down 25 cents. And the June future, $77 the high on the day, the low at 76.45. Settlement price for the June lean hogs at 76.95, 15 cents higher. In just about 7 minutes, I'll return with the closing market report this afternoon when we'll talk with Chuck Shelby. He's at Risk Management Commodities up in Lafayette, Indiana. We'll take a complete look at the agricultural futures markets with him during the closing market report today. Don't forget to tune in for Commodity Week tomorrow. It's at 11:30 Central right here on this radio station, 6 a.m. too. If you want to pick it up, or on our website at willag.org. It will rerun in this slot for the closing market report on Monday because the markets are closed for President's Day. That happens on Monday. You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 in Urbana. Coming up on the top of the hour, it'll be 2 o'clock Central Time.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois.